Welcome to the Imperial MBA Women's Podcast. My name is Ibi Adedugbe, and I'm your host for this week. This week, we will be celebrating Black History Month, and I've got a fantastic lineup of guests for you. The topic for this week is celebrating Black women in the C-suite. It was Ruth Bader Ginsburg who said, "Women belong in all the places where decisions are being made." With my guest today, we'll be discussing their journey to the C-suite and how they've maintained their positions at that level. I will now introduce you to our guests. Our first is Dr. Funke Abimbola. She's a lawyer by background, but has worked in the healthcare executive space. She's also a philanthropist and runs a scholarship fund for medical students from a disadvantaged background. She also holds an MBE and is an EMBA holder. Our second guest is Mamia Kwafo-Akoto. She's also a lawyer by background, but works in asset management space. She works for Allen & Overy, which is one of the top four law firms in the country. Our final guest is Gbemi Abudu, who's an MBA grad from Thunderbird University in America. She has worked in luxury brand management for companies such as Louis Vuitton, and she was also a country brand manager for Jordan. She's currently working in the edtech space, working with the UN in SDG workshop facilitation.
I would like you to start us off, Dr. Abimbola. Tell us what your career path has been so far.
So I've been working for over 20 years now. And the way I describe it really is I've actually had two careers so far. I started off with a career as a solicitor, working as a corporate lawyer in four different law firms, two in central London, two outside central London. And then about 10 years ago, I moved into the global pharmaceutical industry and gradually worked my way up to the C-suite there. So I work for Roche, which is the world's largest biotech company. And when I left, I was general counsel and head of financial compliance. It was a much broader leadership role beyond being a solicitor. So that's my career so far. At the moment, I'm actually running my own consultancy, putting my business studies recently acquired from Wharton School into practice, and actually using my learnings there to run my consultancy business. And I'm looking to go back into a permanent role within Global Pharma next year. So that's the plan currently.
That's fantastic. And Mamia, would you like to tell us about your career path so far?
Yes, I'm a senior associate at Allen & Overy, LLP. I'm based in London. I mainly advise sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, family offices on all aspects of asset management. I think, you know, I've only actually been at Allen & Overy, so my view might be slightly skewed of the law world. That's me, and very much enjoy it there.
That's wonderful. And Gbemi Abudu, would you like to tell us about your career path?
Thank you very much for having me, Ivy. I've had a very, I guess you'd say, interesting and conventional career. At the moment, I'm the founder and managing director of a company called BMG Enterprise Limited, and we're positioned as the finishing school for the fourth industrial revolution, which basically means we provide people tools for them to be able to navigate the business environment. We help organizations reskill and upskill their employees to ensure that they can be successful. They have all the required skills to be successful. And what inspired me to start a company that focused on that was when I moved to Nigeria about 6 years ago. I noticed that there were certain soft skills that your average professional in Nigeria, I felt, were lacking. And from conversations I had with several CEOs and several chairpersons, I realized it was a problem that cut across all sectors. But so my career, I started out in the legal profession, and I went to business school. And after business school, the plan actually was to work for the World Bank or IFC. That was my dream. I wanted to save the world. And as life happens, I met the then CEO of Louis Vuitton. And from a conversation with him, he convinced me that he thought I would have a very good career in the luxury industry. I was reluctant at first, but I explored it and I ended up working at Louis Vuitton after business school. Then that set me on a path of working in the luxury industry from fashion to business aviation. Being my last role in the luxury industry was being vice president of sales and marketing for a private jet company. And after I left that company is when I started BMGA.
That's wonderful. I mean, it sounds like you've successfully navigated working across industries, and it sounds like conversations have changed your career path. I mean, this in current COVID and climates, this is something that people would love to do. And as a Black woman, what would you say has been the most invaluable insight you've gained through your career journey?
So it's interesting you asked that question, because right before hopping on here, we just finished a session with the author of a book called The Serendipity Mindset. And one of the reasons why I really like that book, and I'm not promoting the book for him, it's just that when I read the book, it's a skill. It's the first time I've ever had someone describe serendipity as a skill. And the truth is that was in my life, the biggest skill and one thing that has been consistent across the board for me has been serendipity. You can call it faith, you can call it whatever it is you want, but it's being open to the uncertainties life presents at you. When you say being able to navigate whether it's from one industry to the next, the truth is it makes sense in hindsight, but the truth is it didn't make sense looking forward. It's opportunities present themselves and not being scared to take on those interesting opportunities that come along, and being able to take on those opportunities and also just applying your best. I mean, one thing I always say is no matter what I do in life, I always want to be known as a person of excellence. So that means no matter what industry I go into, no matter where I go into, it's how can I make sure that I'm bringing my best self into that? So for me, I would say serendipity has played a huge factor in my career. And secondly, is developing relationships. It's really those soft skills to me. It's your ability to develop relationships, to be able to have conversations, to be able to connect with any human being. I know that has opened a lot of doors for me than anything else. And that means from being in grad school, where I just got back from Jordan, and I was convinced, considering the work I did in Jordan, I was convinced that the next step would be you have to work for the World Bank, then randomly meeting someone who would change the trajectory of my life. And also after I was done with the luxury industry, it's very easy to tell the story now and say, I started this company. But the reality was when I first started, I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. I knew I wanted to start my own company. I had ideas. I had different things I was exploring, but being open to the uncertainties of life. And as time went on, I realized that, okay, you know what? Focusing on capacity building seems to be a bigger strength of mine than anything else in terms of the service offering the company offered at that point. Then we pivoted. And I think with anything in life, it's that ability to be flexible, you know, and being flexible, because I don't believe anyone can say life happens exactly as planned. The one thing you can be sure of, it's not going to happen as planned. So being open to that and finding a way, learning to build that muscle to navigate through that.
Thank you very much. That was a very spirited answer to that. So I'm going to come back to you, Dr. Abimbola.
I think honestly, for me, the fact that I kept my career going after I became a mum is something, and to have ascended to the heights I did, whilst not failing my son, you know, importantly, I feel that I've been the sort of mother I want to be. That's what I'm really proud of. It's not the achievements in and of themselves. The sort of resilience I've shown as well, looking back, you know, so many people would have indeed given up. I mean, it's not even would have. I know many people who gave up and didn't hang in there for various very valid reasons, because it can be very demoralizing when you're trying to deal with the many, many challenges you face. So I'm proud that I didn't give up. I'm proud that I got promoted and hung in there and continued to up my game. And I'm especially proud of my son, who I just think is the most exceptional young man, and anyone who meets him says so. If I'd failed there, really nothing else would have mattered, if I'm honest with you. To have a confident young man who's almost 18, you know, applying for top universities, that's what makes me really, really proud when I look back, definitely.
That's amazing. That brings me on to my next question, which is, what would you want your legacy to be? What would you want the history books to say about you?
Definitely that I use my accomplishments to help other people, that I was constantly championing others who weren't in a position to champion themselves, you know, creating opportunity, improving visibility, and making sure that potential can be unlocked. You know, when people don't have the avenues, the networks, the resources, whatever it might be, that's the legacy I feel I'm already leaving behind. And it's so important that we're not just chasing accomplishments for the sake of it. I see so much of that in this world. It's got to be about what you can give back to other people. It really has to be. And that will be my legacy, definitely.
That's amazing. And I think that's certainly the focus that most MBA schools are looking at now, and making sure that people look at not just social enterprise, but the ESG and sustainability. So then you, Marmia, what would you define success as for you? Success means many things to many people.
I agree. And I think working in a law firm, I know that a lot of people define success as being a partner, and I don't take away from that. It's a goal that I have. But I think success is to fulfill your full potential. And I think if you can do that, then you've succeeded in that. I think the difficulty is that we have different goals in different areas, which often conflict. So I do agree with Dr. there who spoke about, you know, being successful in raising one's kids. Now that often conflicts with, you know, for me, certainly, you know, the busyness of work and traveling and things. And you know, I want to fulfill my full potential in both being a successful mother, I have two, you know, being a great lawyer. But I think sometimes you have to balance and prioritize. So I think success is quite a loaded word, which is not apparent on you know, just seeing it. But for me, it's fulfilling one's potential, but also balancing one's priorities and thinking about what matters most, which is tough because I think it's easy to say in word, but when they conflict, it's interesting to see the decisions one makes. And I think often you have to remind yourself of what you said your priorities were.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on that in terms of what everyone defines as success and striking the balance of what that means in different parts of the areas of your life. And I think that brings me on to sort of the next question I was going to ask, which is, what brings you joy outside of work? You know, when you try to balance work and life, what are the things that brings you joy outside of work, Armin?
I think for me, joy outside of work is being able to be able to fully switch off, which is very difficult for me and increasingly difficult. But for example, I just made a cake and that was really satisfying, and it didn't stick to the pan, even more satisfying. But, you know, just I think being able to use my skills, what I also find satisfying is helping others. You know, I struggled to get into the legal industry, and, you know, it was very hard. I started off as a paralegal, but it was possible. And, you know, I'm at a top law firm, and I would like others who don't have the social capital that some might to be able to do the same. So it gives me great joy when people are actually bold enough to send an email and ask for help. And, you know, that is difficult sometimes because you're increasingly busy and you're trying to give your arm to everyone. But it does give me joy to see people, you know, fulfilling their full potential as a result of being inspired by the example that, you know, they see in front of them. That's really great.
Yeah. So you mentioned something there, which is social capital. And that is something that many ethnic minority people might not have. And in terms of accessing, you know, careers that are not traditionally common in the ethnic minority communities, how did you go about gaining that social capital?
Yeah, so for me, I decided I wanted to, or my mother decided that I wanted to go into law, you know, when I was doing my A-levels. And one thing I thought would be good was to get some work experience. So I applied to get, I sort of looked in the yellow pages that existed at the time and looked at different law firms and then remembered that my dad had a connection with a lawyer in Mayfair. So I contacted them and for 2 weeks, that particular lawyer didn't answer the phone. I only got his secretary, but after a while I managed to speak to him and he agreed for me to do work experience, and on turning up on the first day it was very clear to me that my world was very different to his. I didn't have any idea as to how to dress, and certainly the way I spoke was it was all not quite lining up to what a Mayfair lawyer what one would expect of that. But I worked there whilst I was finishing my A levels, and then also work experience turned into I think a 3.5 year job. And as a result of that, it sort of taught me what I needed to know, and sort of helped. I wouldn't say it didn't change who I was, but it made it clear to me what I needed to do to work in a professional environment, how I needed to behave. So work experience for me was key. And that then got me, another job at Herbert Smith, just working as a librarian, actually, whilst doing the GDL, which is the Graduate Diploma in Law part-time. And then after that, getting on to A&O. But I think, getting the social capital, I think, to answer your question and try to be strict in doing so, was work experience. And also reaching out to people who I knew were in the legal field, and sort of just trying to, as much as possible, rub shoulders with them. And I know that might sound strange, but I used to get excited if I met someone on the train and I thought, oh, they look like they're a lawyer, or they were leading some form of legal publication. And I'd ask and they'd say yes. And I'd ask for an email address and an email and just sort of make contact, because, it was a world that was very foreign to me. And some of those people that I, met on the train or at an event, I'm still friendly with today. But they helped to, sort of unwrap what to me just seemed like another planet, and sort of told me what I needed to do to get onto the right path. So that really helped and sort of helped me navigate, and still do help me navigate, some of the politics in law firms.
Well, that's amazing. And I think that is, in the current COVID environment, for people who are graduating at the moment and trying to figure out what their next step, what their next move is, the promise of gaining this education and being landed with a job at their feet. Most people feel like that's been taken away from them. And, for people who have run businesses as well, they often feel, burdened with the trying to strike the balance of success and balancing life outside of work as well. So I'm going to ask you, Wimmy, how do you prioritize the things that bring you joy outside of work? And how do you manage to consistently achieve that?
Great question. I wouldn't use the word balance at all when it comes to anything in life, to be honest, because I find that there are times when I have to give all my attention to work and there are times when I don't. I always say that I go based on my mood at any given time, to be honest. For me, there are certain things that I have determined a part of who I am as a person. So work is very important to me. My personal life, being able to spend time with family, is very important to me. I love the outdoors. Being able to either run or walk or go hiking is very important to me. So I wouldn't say balance. I mean, there are times when I'm very busy with work that I don't have time to go hiking or to do any of the outdoor sports I love to do, and I just don't do it. And I don't beat myself up for not being able to do it. I say it's the same thing with family, where there are times, I always try to make it, because they're all important to me. I try to make sure I make time for everything, but there are points in life when realistically you can't, because one demands more than the other. There are times when family demands more than work. Guess what? Work will just have to suffer for that period. So it's the way I've found peace with handling that. I find that word balance to be a bit of I think it sets you up for failure, because you feel like you're not balancing everything, then it's like, oh my gosh, then something must be going wrong. But when I find that, I say that whatever is taking up my time at a given time, give it that attention. if you can, I mean, I'll say, I mean, IB, you know this about me. I love to run. Yesterday was the first time I've had time to go run in 2 weeks. Did I feel bad? No, because if I can run every other day, I would, but I haven't had the time. There are other things that are taking priority over that, and I just make the time for that. So it's sort of the way I found my peace with that, and it's taken years to get to that point, because earlier in my career, I tried to find balance, and I would always feel like a failure because I couldn't balance everything. Like, you're trying to give everything equal attention. And when I told myself and said, and because maybe more so, maybe my last job, I had a very high pressure job. And I told myself that, you know what, it's okay if you can't, if you don't feel like waking up at 5 o'clock to go running today, that's fine. The world is not going to end, right? If it's moments when I can't travel to spend Thanksgiving with my family because something else has happened, something else is going on, it's okay. It's as long as I'm making sure that all the elements of what makes me who I am are showing up, basically. I should say they're showing up in my life. So that's how I've been able to navigate that word of balance. I don't think there's a balance. That's my personal take on that.
And I agree with you. And I think, you know, it's the maturity of years that takes one to that point where you accept that there are things that will have to take priority over other things. So I'll come to you, Dr. Obimbola. Like, you know, this is the time when everyone is aware of mental health issues and protecting their own mental well-being. So I would like to ask, you know, as a woman who's worked in the C-suite, who's worked at very high profile levels, how do you fortify and protect your mental well-being when dealing with stresses both at work and outside of work as well?
That's a really, really good question. It helps that I come from a family of doctors, I must say. I was supposed to read medicine and didn't, but that's another podcast in itself as to what unraveled there. But we've got all specialities covered within the family, including two psychiatrists, my mom included. I mean, joking apart, you know, it does really help when you have people who care about you, who are close to you, who can be your eyes and ears filter. I'm not always the best at knowing when I need to slow down. Getting the right sort of outlets for the stress and sense of who you are. And because what I found in the working world, in the diaspora, which is where we all are, is you really need to know who you are as a Black woman, because especially when we're ambitious and driven, it so goes against what most people who aren't Black have experienced, that you're constantly up against what my mum says psychiatrists call cognitive dissonance, where, you know, mentally they just can't deal with it, literally cannot compute that you can be confident, articulate, know where you're headed, well-educated, you know, born to privilege, which I was. There's so much about me that is a challenge for those who haven't experienced that of a Black woman. And I've come across that in every single role I've been in. So mental health-wise, knowing who I am and remembering who I am has been a really, really important part of that. And not denying aspects of who you are either, which is why I'm always talking about my son, because I was amazed that there'd be lots of working women who never talked about their children. You know, there were people I knew who were mothers who somehow just never discuss their children. I thought, well, that's a key part of your working life. I mean, how can you not? You know, it's shaped my leadership. I've turned down job opportunities because they would conflict with that. So I like to bring my whole self to the table, as it were. And that really helps me with mental health. I don't do well if I feel like I'm having to hide aspects of who I am. So I hope that gives you an idea of how I deal with that. It's good family support and friends support, and really knowing who you are, you know, reaffirming that self-talk even really, really helps. Knowing whose daughter you are, and we're both Nigerian, right? So, you know, a lot of us from Nigeria, Ghana, and other parts of the world, knowing who you are is very important, you know, really understanding your identity. And that has really, really helped me a lot.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So I love what you said about knowing who you are, because it comes back to core values, really. I'll bring this to you, Marmia. You know, we've just talked about, you know, having a support network. What does your support network look like?
My support network, I think, is possibly to the envy of some. I have a mother who lives with me 4 days a week and looks after my children. I have a very supportive husband who is in no way intimidated by my success. Great sisters who are just always there. An amazing sponsor at work who has nothing to prove anymore and so therefore really wants to push all that I am. And you know, that I think that is, you know, extremely important. You need all of that. You need it in the workplace, you need it outside of the workplace. I should also say I've got some really great friends, and you know, they didn't come overnight, but I think if you need support in all those areas, because I think sometimes actually my husband just doesn't want to hear it, but most of the time even if he doesn't, he does, and he's great. But you know, then on the children's side, you know, I never really have to worry about, you know, if I'm traveling, and you know, COVID's been a blessing because I haven't traveled in a while, but if I am traveling, you know, I never need to worry about if my kids have eaten, because my mum is there, or you know, my husband's looked after them, I know they're sleeping, they're fine. And I know that that's not the case for a lot of families in the UK, because to say that, you know, your mother lives with you is strange. A nanny is more what people are used to. So, you know, I think for me, that support network has really allowed me to progress, you know, take shorter maternity leaves. My mum's an ex-midwife. You know, I've really been blessed in that area. And then I think in terms of work, having a great sponsor, you know, I think, you know, Doctor, what you said is right. Like, knowing who you are is very important, but it's very difficult sometimes to discover that when you're receiving conflicting messages. And so I think when you've got a sponsor who says, I'm going to help you, I'm going to talk in rooms that you can't, that is important. And I've experienced that. So that has been very useful for me.
That's a, as you said, an amazing setup that you have, and that's what enables, you know, most women to be able to function in the roles of leading companies and leading organizations and working in the C-suite essentially. And I'd like you all to answer this question just like in a minute, just summarize, how do you manage the loneliness of being at the top as a woman and as a Black woman? Sorry, I'll start with
who's going first. everyone's been very quiet suddenly. Leaning on my support network so you don't feel isolated. My son has been amazing despite his very young age, and has been coming with me to events that where I've been speaking and Parliament and you name it since he was 10, and it was purely because of childcare issues, and you know, and then he became very interested genuinely in coming with me. So from that point of view, it's not been terribly lonely. I've taken mentees with me to events. It's been very exciting for them to meet MPs, you know, go to the House of Commons or whatever it might be. Within the actual workplace setting itself though, it has been lonely. It's been very hard at times to find people that I feel I can trust enough to let them in, you know, to understand. I've had very good mentors that I've trusted, and they've helped as well. And I've had the benefit of a really good executive coach when I've been working and still do. And that's what's helped. So it's all about support. The one word I would say is support networks.
Okay. Jamie, I would like you to answer this as well.
So I couldn't agree more. It is support. I love what you said where, for me, I always said that with life, there are periods when you're alone or phases when you're alone, but you're not lonely, right? And I would say the loneliness, definitely going through this entrepreneurial journey, has been lonely. But what I'm finding is that being able to talk to friends who have gone through the same journey as well and learning from them, the support definitely has to be like family and friends. I would say there are days when I second guess myself. There are days when I doubt my ability. When you're facing an insane challenge, I mean, I'll give an example of when we launched this these BMJ Fellows program in May of this year, and because COVID started in March, and majority of our corporate sponsors pulled out their financial support, And at that point, I'm like, I'm done. I can't even do this, because I was leaning on their financial support to be able to execute the program at the level in which I wanted to. But the truth is, without family and friends who convinced me and said, don't worry, you got this, how can I help? I would have not proceeded with the program this year. So just really having a strong tribe. I love what you said earlier, where it's like, I didn't build my tribe overnight, where it's taking years, where you've been able to surround yourself with people of like minds, people who, I'll say, from my mentors to individuals who I consider who I'm mentees to, and people who are my sponsors. I find that at any given time when the journey gets tough, I mean, I don't even just say, I find that for me, it's not loneliness that ends up being the problem. It's, there are a lot of times when I face challenges that you're just constantly wondering, how do I get over this? How do I tackle this? And just having a cheerleader, just having that balance for me has been very helpful in my career.
And Marmia, you get the final word on this question. How do you manage the sort of loneliness at the top? So, you know, most people feel like they need their own boardroom, internal boardroom, to help them with some of the difficult decisions. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I think for me, it's a combination of many things. Certainly one is my faith. And I think that has been how I've actually coped with some very difficult, lonely times. I think it can be really hard, actually, working in a professional services environment as a woman, as a mother, being Black. And I think my faith has actually just helped, certainly with mental health, that's for sure. I think also my husband's been great at that, because sometimes you actually don't particularly want to cry again in the office. You just need to come and do it at home. And having someone who gives you the Kleenex is great. I think also an executive coach, I think, is good. And I have fortunately had access to that. I know not all will be able to have access to that, because often it's funded by the organisation that you work for. But, you know, initially I thought, you know, this is all nonsense, I don't need this. But actually, you know, sitting down and just sort of strategizing with someone and working through, you know, some difficult, complex situations is very useful. So I've had the benefit of that. And again, I think I'd say sponsors and people in the workplace who have just gone before you. Sometimes they're within your organization, sometimes they're outside of, but having access to those people is key, because sometimes they can just say, that's nonsense, the answer is this. And I think that has been key. I think one other thing is to say that clearly in all of this, it's important to talk. I think it's important not to bottle it all up and think that you've got it. So, you know, I think I've made it clear that in all of the points where I'm saying, you know, I've had, you know, the sort of keys to this, to dealing with the loneliness, it's been by communicating with people. I could never just do it by my own and just sitting there writing in a diary. It wouldn't work for me. Maybe it works for others, but for me, it's the people that helped to get you there.
That's absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. So now we move on to the next segment. In the last year, essentially, there has been so many racial tensions and uprisings around the world. And this has had an impact on many people around the world. So what I would like you to tell me is, if you've had any experiences of any racial discrimination or microaggressions during your career, especially when you've been in leadership roles, so in the C-suite where, you know, Black women are not normally seen, and more importantly, how have you navigated around that? How did it affect you, and how would you manage it again if you encounter the situation again? So I will start with you, Bomi, actually.
Oh, that's a very good question. So it's interesting, and I suspect the other speaker is going to attest to this as well. Is being Nigerian, when I first moved to the US, I really didn't see things through the lens of race. I really didn't. And there's a particular encounter that after examining it years later is when I realized that was probably my first real encounter with racism in the US, but I didn't realize that that's what it was then. Because typically it's like if something goes wrong, somebody's not nice to you, they treat you a certain way, you're trying to figure out, what did I do wrong? You're internalizing it thinking you did something wrong, or trying to deduct what are all the other possible options before ever thinking about that. I remember my freshman year in college, and that's how far back, that I remember a particular class I had. I remember being late to that class, and I don't know what impression the professor had of me, but I asked him several questions that he seemed shocked that I had done my reading ahead of time, and I asked him those questions. And after class, he told me to see him after class, and he was like, very, very, very great questions. And he was like, you're smarter than you look. And I remember I was just like, okay, whatever. And I think I was having a conversation with my then roommate, maybe 3 weeks later, when I said, oh, my professor said this, I thought it was kind of weird. And she was like, weird? I mean, she's like, don't you see, when he says, look, what do you think he meant? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I didn't think of it as being black. I mean, I think about it. I went to school at the University of Wyoming. How many black people did you have in Wyoming at that time? Not that many of us. So that was the first time I really encountered, for me, racism. I would say that was more so like in an academic setting. Then professionally, honestly, and this is going to sound weird, and I set that to sort of set the stage for saying that if I look at my interaction from the different organizations I've worked at in the US before moving to Nigeria, I really never examined the way I was treated from a race perspective. What I always found that was very glaring was I was treated a certain way because I was a woman. I saw the woman aspect more than I saw the race. And when I say woman, I would see my counterparts who were women being treated the same. So it wasn't, so for me at that point, it's like if I see a white colleague being treated, being relegated because she's a white colleague, and me being black and being relegated as well for being, at that point you realize that our male counterparts didn't have to deal with the same issues that we dealt with. So I've always, for me, my experience has been more along the lines of how I was treated being a woman. And you move to a place like Nigeria, which I did 6 years ago, and that's why I'm saying that for me, the woman one has been one that has been very glaring, if I have to be honest. Is moving to Nigeria, I say a particular incident last year actually comes to mind where I'm giving a presentation and I was the only woman in the room. And at the end of giving the presentation, a very high government official looks at me and said, everything I presented was a scam. And I found it very interesting, literally said, this is a scam. He's like, you keep talking about women, women, where do you women think you're going? Said this to me in a meeting and I honestly didn't know how to react. And it was very interesting that you had other men in the room and nobody spoke out on my behalf. And I froze because I froze at first, then I finally caught myself and said, no, it's not a scam, and defended my work. But I found it very interesting that none of my male counterparts in the room spoke up on my behalf. They all sort of like, maybe they were scared, I don't know, but nobody said anything. So honestly, in other areas, maybe, but in the professional setting and academic setting, I honestly cannot point to one incident that I would say that it was me being treated a certain way because of my race. I can point to situations where I was treated a certain way because of my gender. I've seen that. But with race, if I have to be very honest, I think part of that is because for the longest time, I didn't see things through that lens. Like I would examine everything first, but it's when I've looked at things in hindsight and tried to understand certain situations, I can look back then and see and identify that's what it was. But at that moment in time, I didn't see it in that light.
Okay. All right. And that brings me to you, Marmia. I mean, asset management is not an area where you typically see black people working in. And, you know, you're a black woman working in the legal side of asset management. Have you had any experiences of racial tensions or racial discriminations or microaggressions?
Absolutely. I think I'm very happy to speak about them openly because I think it's important to, certainly with the George Floyd movement, I found that a lot of people say, but what do you mean? What kind of racism are black people experiencing? And I think I've experienced microaggressions and outright racism throughout my career, actually, and still do today. But fortunately, it hasn't limited my progression. It had the opportunity to, but I didn't allow it to. I remember coming back from a holiday once, and someone asking me if I brought back any chocolate covered cockroaches. I think that's pretty obvious. I remember once going to going to being in a particular embassy, about to travel, waiting for a visa, and a chap asking me, you know, what do I do for a living? And I explained, and he then said, you know, his daughter worked at a competitor. And he said, oh, you know, she was very junior. He asked how senior I was. I said, I'm quite senior, and so forth, and said, you know, why I was traveling. And then there was silence. And then he said to me, how did you get into A&O? And I knew exactly what he was saying, but I said, I applied. How did your daughter get in? And I think for him, he then realized what I was saying, but it was clear to me what he was thinking was, you know, maybe a number of things, maybe, you know, I don't see black people, you know, in the magic circle, or, you know, certainly in sort of firms in the city or whatever. But it was clear to me that, you know, my race had caused him to think as to how far I could progress within a certain profession. And to be honest, was slightly upsetting. But I think it was in some ways also nice to be able to show him that actually there are black people around in that arena. So I've had that. You know, at work, I'm often mistaken for the PA. So I've been asked often if I'm on the late shift. And, you know, these are not necessarily, I wouldn't say that's racism, but that's just unfortunately being a victim of circumstance, of the fact that you're in organisations where there are very few black people around. I've been asked if I'm, you know, the BD lady, and if I could come back later, when actually I'm far more senior to the person that I'm talking to. So I've had all of that. But I think you step back from that and you think, okay, that might be your view, but I won't allow that to be an excuse as to why I progress. So I can't, I don't want to sugarcoat it, because I think it's important. You know, when I started in law, I remember someone saying, don't allow race to be a chip on your shoulder, but don't also be ignorant to pretend it's not there. And so it is there. And, you know, my hope is, fortunately, my hope is that when my daughter is, you know, my age, that she doesn't have to deal with these struggles. But even if she does, she will be able to progress.
Yeah, I mean, those are quite, I've also got an emotional reaction to those experiences you just narrated there. I'll come to you, Dr. Abimbola. You know, have you had any experiences, and, you know, how did you navigate around those, and what would you do to, you know, handle it if you were in the same situation again?
I've had so many that I actually spoke about this at a Race at Work summit 2 months ago. And it's been at all stages of my career as well. And the nature of the microaggressions have changed slightly as I've progressed. So at entry level, it was not being able to get my foot in the door and having to make over 150 phone calls just to get my entry level role to get into the profession. And the backdrop of this is that I'm privately educated. I went to a top law school. I had all the grades. You know, I speak the way I do. I mean, these are things I just thought, of course I'm going to get into law. There's no question. So it could have been nothing but race. I mean, if you look at ruling out all the other things, it was the name was an issue. I was obviously African and so on. I've interviewed with the BBC about it many, many times and got a lot of publicity about that issue. So that was at entry level. Being mistaken for the personal assistant, the secretary, the paralegal, the legal exec, anything but the solicitor, it was a regular occurrence when I was more junior. I mean, there are so many examples of that. At reception, reporting in, and it's assumed you're there for the secretarial role, and you couldn't possibly be there to be interviewed for the corporate solicitor's role. I had a recruiter say that corporate law, which is all I wanted to do, was too competitive for a black woman. He didn't just say a woman, he actually said black woman. When I became more senior, the nature of the microaggressions changed. It then became clear that I was a real threat to a lot of the white men. I mean, that really is what we're talking about here. So I'd hear things like, you're over promoting, you know, you're promoting yourself too much. And when I'd ask for examples, they never stacked up. I mean, I remember once someone said to me that in a team photo of six people, that I was in the middle of the team photo. And I said, it's impossible to be in the middle of a group of people where there's an even number. So there'll be two of us equally in the middle. And I said, the only reason you've noticed me is because I'm the only Black woman. But this was 6 or 7 weeks after the person said it, because in that moment, you start questioning yourself, am I, you know, and on and on and on. Many other examples given of where I was overpromoting, when actually, because I was the only Black woman involved in whatever it was, I was noticed more. Everything you do is visible. You know, people comment on everything you do. You're under a microscope all the time. The pressures that go with that are unbelievable. I was constantly told with surprise by one senior leader, you're so articulate, you're so well-spoken, you're so, you know, again, he was genuinely surprised he'd met a Black woman who spoke as well. I called him up on it and I said, why is it such a surprise to you? Because he wasn't saying this to anyone else who was white, you know, so why is it that you're saying this to me? Everyone else is well-spoken. So you're clearly surprised that I'm so well-spoken. And it turned out that he'd never worked with a senior black woman before. In fact, I was the first in his whole career. And so on and on and on and on and on. I mean, there's so many examples. I did a whole conference, conversation and presentation on it. The way I deal with it is, again, it goes back to that sense of identity. Sometimes you're so angry and upset, you have to remind yourself not to show the emotion in the heat of the moment. Because I'm a very fiery character. And honestly, it could be really unprofessional the way I could react at that, and with justification as well. But would that really serve a wider purpose? Of course not. So first thing I would say, and indeed what I said at this conference was, you know, find a safe space to actually process the emotion. Don't lash out at work and fall into the stereotype of the angry Black woman and all the rest of it. Then, you know, once you're calmer, talk about it with whoever you feel will understand and get it. And the third thing is to actually do something about it, if you feel that it's actually worth doing. So this senior leader who kept saying I was overpromoting, you know, it was causing real issues for me within that work context, because it wasn't true, but that's what he was saying to other people. And, you know, and I really called him up on it in a way that he was so embarrassed. I mean, it became very clear that it was his own prejudice at play. He then became a very strong ally for all the race initiatives. For me in that instance, it was worth calling him up. And, you know, with most people, it's not worth it. You just have to be who you are, stand firm, continue to excel. But it is hard, you know. I mean, I still get it now. I had someone at a panel of prominent women in law, and, you know, this person knew that that was what we were at an investment bank last summer. You know, I was there as a president of the Law Society, a senior QC barrister, another prominent banking lawyer, and me, and we were all being interviewed for a prominent Women in Law Project podcast. And we all said our names, and he said about my name, so no one else's name. And he was an IT tech guy. I mean, you know, he said, do you mind if I call you Dave? I can't say your name. This is someone who was so much more junior. Exactly. I can see. Wow. For those listening to the podcast, we're actually all on video and I can see the reaction from my co-panelists on this. I was so shocked. In fact, the ladies with me gasped, because I think it was the first time they'd ever really seen what I've been trying. But he actually said, I want to call you Dave. He was laughing. And I said, my name's not Dave. If you can say Dave, you can say Funke. This is how you pronounce my name. And he knew I was a senior woman. He knew I was prominent. He knew I was there because of my prominence in my profession. But he thought nothing of it. And I was so angry. I thought, I will not have this from you. There is no way. He was very embarrassed and apologetic. But, you know, this was last summer, after the MBE, after the honorary doctorate, after, you know, everything. And he just think, really, you know? So it's hard. You need to know who you are, and you need to really be able to bounce back, have extra layers of skin, not take it personally, don't carry it away with you. But I'm still talking about these things now, and some of them happened 20 years ago. So it is hard. It's very difficult. I don't think we ever truly get over how to manage microaggressions, because they're like mosquito bites, that, you know, one or two here and there is fine. But over time, they really do wear you down. They chip away your sense of worth, self-esteem, confidence, and so on. So I have plenty to say about this, but I think on that note, I'll stop before we run out of time.
No, I mean, you truly just narrated, you know, the feeling that a lot of Black women get in the workplace when they have situations where they're microaggressions. So this leads on to the next question, because this is all about changing the narrative. And, you know, whilst we celebrate being Black women working in, you know, leadership positions around the world. So as a business leader, as a leader in your organization, as an entrepreneur, what advice would you have for women in the C-suite about how to make their organizations truly inclusive and truly diverse and truly representative of the society that we live in today?
Is what I would say. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, I started doing my diversity work. It's never been my full-time role. It's always been on top of the day job. And it is actually as simple as leading by example. Making sure you yourself are inclusive in your leadership, you know, because even within the minority ethnic community, there can be a real hierarchy, and we have to be very mindful that we're seen to be supporting each other, even within our own communities. And then that's when sort of more focused, targeted interventions come into play. I mean, the sorts of things that I've encouraged law firms and wider industry to do is setting targets around specific goals at entry level and at senior leadership level, the underlying action plans to make sure those targets will be reached, recruiting from a wider range of universities and not just the Russell Group, which a lot of law firms still focus on, speaking to school children. So I was doing that anyway, so it was very easy for me to say to others that if you commit to doing one talk to, you know, a struggling school, show them what's possible and show the young people what they can do, and, you know, they can then strive and achieve, offering the work experience opportunities, you know, just one day here and there. It doesn't have to be a massive thing. You know, there's so many things like that that over time have built this body of work that I now have, you know, within the diversity and inclusion space. So that's what I would say actually helps. And then shining the spotlight on others who can't tell their story. So I do that through social media. I'm about to announce, I run a medical scholarship scheme quite separately, you know, in memory of my father. And I'm about to announce this year's winners, you know, exceptional medical students. They're all minority ethnic, fantastic stories, etc. Every year we do this, and I promote them and, you know, follow their progress. And it really, I get so many views, comments, and it's all about them. You know, I tend to focus on other people with my use of social media far more than myself. And that makes a big difference. It really matters how we position ourselves as people. And me using my influence to shine a spotlight on other people is really part of that as well. So I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, no, that's truly amazing. And I have to say that I think the inaugural medical student who got the scholarship from your fund that you set up is from Imperial College.
She is, yes.
She's also my alma mater, so I, you know, I haven't said before, but so that's, you know, certainly something that we're very grateful for, you know, for people like yourself in leadership roles in the business world, actually changing, looking back and changing the narrative and change, you know, leaving the door open for other people to come true. So, you know, that brings me on to my next question. And this one is for you, Bimi. So I know you've been involved with the UN in terms of SDG workshop capacity building. Tell us a little bit about that and how true projects like this, you know, one can improve the diversity in the workplace for future generations.
Thank you, Ivy. So I kind of want to follow up on what Dr. Funke said, because they're connected. For me, the key thing was there's a certain level of intentionality that is required. And I think that burden at this point, it's sad to say, falls on us women to ensure that we speak up. Speak up even when it's uncomfortable. So I think, like I mentioned earlier to the previous question, even when I was in the US and maybe I didn't quite assess the situation I was going through the lens of race, it did bother me to look around and not see men that looks like me around me. And I will bring it up in meetings. I will talk about it. To some people, it became a nuisance. I did not care, because I felt like as long as I have a seat at the table, I have to make sure that I make room for others like me to be at that table. And that brings me to the work I do now. I mean, I started the BMG Fellows Program because when I moved to Nigeria, and I hate to say this, some people don't agree with me, but in spite of the privileges, the background, there's still an element of me that felt like a second-class citizen in Nigeria. I did. I mean, the example Dr. Funke gave where people will mistake you for your PA, I would have that happen. I'll go to a meeting with my assistant, and he's a man dressed in a suit, and people would assume that he's the boss. And you will always say, no, she's the one. And not just that, you find that there are so many challenges that women have to overcome in the world in general. And I had to ask myself that from my perspective, if I look at my experience, if I look at my network, if I look at the access I have in life, what can I do being intentional to make life slightly easier for the next generation of women? How can I take all my experience, all my challenges, all my learnings and create something where other women can learn from? They don't have to go through 20 years and learn from their mistakes. Like, why don't you put your mistakes together, the learnings, and sort of present a rules of engagement for young women? So that's why I created the BMG Fellows Program, was really identifying what are the key skills that are important for a woman to be successful in the 21st century. You look at soft skills are so important. I mean, I can't overemphasize the importance of soft skills, because being able to network, having great communication skills, written or verbal, that opens a lot of doors for you. Mentorship, having access. When you talk about social capital, how do you build social capital? For some people, it comes naturally. For others, somebody needs to teach them and show them how to do that. So the whole idea was, how do you build a program that provides a young woman all these skills? And I was very fortunate that I got a lot of help along the way. And the idea was building a program. I mean, we worked with the UN, we worked with Yale University, we worked with Cambridge. And the whole idea was, how do you have all these classes? And when I say classes, is telling somebody you need to develop your emotional intelligence is one thing. Telling them they need to build confidence. How do you build confidence? How do you make someone more assertive? All those are very important in the business environment. So that's how we created this program. And so far, it's been very interesting. You talk about when you say SDGs, for us, it was quality education, because you have a lot of universities in Nigeria. I'll say Nigeria, but next year, we're expanding to 4 other African countries next year. You have all these universities in Nigeria that are turning out university graduates, men and women, yearly. And they're not employable. So it's like, how do you ensure they have employability skills? So we partnered with different local universities and said, you know what, why don't we finish your students? So, but we're starting now by focusing just on the female graduates. So how do you ensure that we're giving them skills they did not get while they were in school? How do you provide one of the two most interesting classes for me personally in the program is the Champions of Africa History Lecture Series. And it's very important for young women, people in general, to know their history and being able to teach them about the women who came before you, the women who paved the way for you, like all the rights and all the benefits you're enjoying today, somebody fought for that. So for you to know that there's a burden on you as well, that you have to shift the needle for the next generation. So in that class, we also discussed the issues that affect African women. We talked about colorism. People don't talk about that. It's like you talk about, why do young women feel the need to have to bleach their skin? We have this discussion. You talk about, we talked about natural hair. The whole issue of, is natural hair professional? Is it not? These are conversations that we know exist in the professional setting, but are not necessarily really being discussed about. So creating a safe space for them to discuss that. Then for me personally, it was very important for me to, the class I taught in the program is called the business etiquette class. And in that class, I'll talk about a lot of the mistakes I made in my career, a lot of the assumptions I made in my career, and how to ensure that they don't have to make the same mistakes. How do you ensure that when you're in a company, you really try to find an ally very quickly? Like, how do you find a mentor within the organization so you have somebody who's looking out for you? So literally just creating a program where you're giving them the rules of engagement, you're trying to let them know that we talk about gender equality, but for me with gender equality, it's really been about a lot of the things we're doing with the program. We also have to educate the male counterparts as well, for the male counterparts to know that this is the role you have to play in this. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, I experienced this last year where I expected one of my male colleagues in that meeting should have spoken up for me, but nobody did. And for them to realize that it's very important that if you're going to be an ally, you really have to show up. So that's what we've done with the program. And for me, it's been very important that our generation has to shift the needle for the next generation, and the next generation shifts the needle for the next generation, that in order for us to attain gender equality, as we say, it's if everybody plays their part regularly. And I think intentionality is such a key word, because it's so easy for you to say, because I'm not affected by this. And like I said, even although when I worked for certain organizations in the US, it's in hindsight that I can say that the person was being racist towards me. But I didn't see it at that moment in time. But although I didn't see it at that moment in time, whenever I found myself in a leadership position, I wanted to ensure that there were people that looked like me around me. And in order to do that, you have to be very intentional. So in regards to what BMGA is doing right now, that's what we're doing to ensure that we empower the next generation of young women. The first class is graduating in 3 weeks, which I'm really excited about that. And my goal is honestly in 5 years to have really reskill and upskill about 10,000 young women in Nigeria.
That's truly, truly amazing. And Mamia, I would like you to answer this with regards to, you know, the financial world. You know, that's an area, again, like we've said through the podcast, that there are not many Black people, there are not many VC fund or, you know, PE equity people. You know, what are you doing in terms of that space and championing the next generation?
Good question. I am very intentional about promoting talent. So to the extent, there is someone that passes through the group that I think as a trainee or whatever, or that I come into contact with through organisations such as Black Solicitors Network, I'm very intentional about, you know, talking about what I do, talking about the highs and lows of it, and providing people with access to work experience. And as Dr. said, you know, it can just be a day. It could even just be half a day. It could actually just be letting them come to the building for lunch and sort of feeling quite pumped by that. And, you know, I'm doing all of those things. I think one thing I've realized as I've got more senior is that you have influence, and it's important that you you don't remain silent and that you use your influence in the right way. And I'm very intentional about that. So if there is a cause that I feel that needs to be promoted, then I'm very happy to support that and be quite loud about that. And also to be the person in the room that says, actually, you know, your judgment is off for these reasons. And not to use the race card just because one can, certainly in this environment, to not do that at all, but certainly to make sure that those who have talent progress. So I'm very, one thing we've done at A&O is we have a Black Lawyers Affinity Group, and we fortunately have funding for, you know, professional coaching and things like that. And that's something that I founded. So, you know, I'm very passionate about making sure that the door doesn't close behind me, because to me, that would not be success.
Yeah. Thank you so much. The conversation has been absolutely riveting. Thank you all for bringing your whole self into this room and for being vulnerable and just telling us about how you've navigated the business world and attained success and maintained success, actually. So thank you so much. I hope our listeners will enjoy listening to your pearls of wisdom. Thank you very much.
Thank you.